Hi, I'm Greg Schaefer, and welcome to the Virtual CISO Moment. Mike Pedrick joins us today. He is the VP of Cybersecurity Consulting at Newspire. Mike, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Would love to hear your story. Why did you get started in IT and cyber to begin with? It's kind of a very stressful field at times, and take us up through your career to where you're at today.
Sure. So reaching into the Wayback Machine, I suppose. Based on interests as a teenager, I thought I wanted to be an architect when I got out of high school. And not systems architect, you know, architect building architecture.
Right.
And so I started down that path. I actually earned an associate's degree toward that process and spent 4 years in architectural design before realizing that I cared more about budgets and closing out projects on time and ensuring that the GC could actually build the thing than I did about design itself. And so I burned out of that career field, you know, pretty spectacularly. And that was right about the time of the dot-com boom, and people were pulling in six-figure salaries for just being able to power on a PC. And so it was fairly alluring. I went back to school and finished school just in time for the dot-com bubble to burst, and entered information technology via another architectural firm by selling.
I think we're kind of almost at a burst right now, too. I don't mean to interrupt, but it kind of feels like that. There's a lot of people who got in when there was a lot of money to be made and a lot of opportunity, and now there's a little bit of a burst. So the only reason why, I apologize, I usually don't interrupt, but I want to emphasize to people that it's cyclical. It does go up. It does go on. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, slight digression, but I think what surprises me this time is the level of surprise is back. Everybody was shocked when the dot-com bubble burst. And I remember hearing some dissenting opinions that said, just as you just did, it's cyclical. It's okay. We'll be fine. And, you know, that proved to be true. And here we are again, where people are shocked to find out that it's still true, that it's that markets are cyclical and this sort of thing can happen. So anyway, I moved into IT by selling an architectural firm on the idea that I could do both jobs, and needed a place to incubate my IT career, and they gave me that opportunity, and that was fantastic. I transitioned from there to an executive level information technology role at a manufacturing firm, and ran all things IT and security for that organization for the better part of 8 years. During that process, though, we had an audit, and the auditors came in and evaluated all of our processes. It was an audit spurred on by our insurance provider. And they came in and they evaluated my security program. And I can't even tell you, it was so long ago, I can't tell you exactly what they evaluated us against. It was probably a proprietary set of controls expectations. I failed miserably. And I thought, when they came to me and asked, you know, what I was doing, I said, well, I have a state-of-the-art firewall. I have a Cisco PIX. And it's configured the best way possible and everything else.
You were expecting like flying colors. It's like, yeah. I'm great. You know, you can't find anything unless you plant something there.
Yep. 100%. I thought it was perfect. And they said, in point of fact, no, it is not perfect by any stretch of the imagination. And so I made the decision there. I mean, this is a smallish organization. I think we had, you know, seven sales offices, but one main manufacturing facility, about 120 employees. And I thought to myself, I know I'm in the small and medium-sized business space. I generally have a good sense of, I invested in my education, I've got experience in the field, so on and so forth. But if I was this ignorant to some of the things that I was being shown in that moment, other folks in the small and medium-sized business space have to be as well. And so that led me into moving over into consulting full-time, dedicated consultant. And, you know, security exclusively now for the better part of 10 years. And, you know, again, it's largely the same sort of thing that, preaching the gospel to small and medium sized business clients to say, I know you feel as though, you know, you're not a target, you're too small to be a target, you don't have anything of value. But realistically speaking, and this is such an unfortunate paradigm or parallel to draw, is convenience stores still get robbed. They don't have anything, you know, significant. They might have, you know, pennies in the till, depending on the time of night. They still get robbed. And it's because they just don't have the defenses, right? They're easier at that point. It's the same thing with small and medium-sized businesses from a technological perspective. So I also, in addition to being a consultant and building consulting practices over the years, I'm also a trainer. I found tremendous value in what I perceive to be giving back to the community by teaching folks, you know, here's the practical realities of information security, especially with regard to, you know, the business world, trying to draw security folks closer to business acumen, and also trying to instill information security practices in business folks, just to bring those two things together, because I think that that's a glaring hole in our industry in a lot of places, but especially...
Which one is harder?
Which one? Candidly, I think it's harder. I find it more challenging to bring security folks to the business world.
That's right? What I was thinking you were going to say.
Yeah, because, you know, security folks, it's a certain personality type that I think gets drawn to information security and security in general. And there's nothing, I'm not by any stretch of the imagination saying there's anything wrong with that. But what I will say is that there's a singularity of focus. You know, I must protect this thing. I must stand guard. I'm ever vigilant. I'm going to make sure this thing is protected, et cetera. I've got blinders on to other realities. In fact, it's mildly entertaining often when I am teaching a class and I tell somebody who's got several decades of experience in the security world that there are perfectly legitimate cases where you would say with a straight face, I am not going to do something to protect this system, this information, whatever.
Absolutely.
Explode. Like, what do you mean not protect it? I don't understand. What is that? What color is the sky in your world? I don't understand that statement at all. It doesn't make any sense.
My epiphany with that, if you will, in my career was probably about plus or minus like maybe 23 years ago. I've said this story before on the podcast, to make a very long story short, it involved bringing fiber optics to a new building on campus, the college I was working at. And we had always said that it had to be in conduit and encased in concrete because of, you know, backhoes coming and all that, because that's what happens. And the CFO of the university said, no, we're going to accept the risk. And I was aghast. I was like, how can you accept the risk there? He's like, there's nobody that's going to dig in that area for the next 25 years, at least. And you know what? Nobody's dug in that area for 25 years.
Right.
And that was the epiphany for me. That's exactly what you're talking about. It is tough to get to that point, because I think up until that point, I maybe I'm wrong. And this was my experience is like, I always felt like I had to be right. Mm-hmm. And how dare you tell me, I'm the technology SME. How dare you tell me that this solution is wrong? I mean, it hurt my ego. Mm-hmm. Check the ego at the door and start learning stuff with regards to learning the business acumen. I totally agree with you. And I was kind of hoping you were going to say that.
Yeah, I had a similar case where I was working ultimately for an individual who was worth a appreciable amount of money. And he was very, I'm not going to say he was risk hungry. I'm going to say that there just wasn't any room in his day to think about risk. I mean, he was full bore. We're going to make money. We're going to grow the business. We're going to, you know, world domination. We're bent on world domination. And he would ask for things that I would bristle at. You know, he would ask for certain things, you know, tantamount to giving, you know, throwing the doors wide open, you know, come pillage the store, so to speak. And I would push back and say, listen, here's what's at stake. Here's what the risks are. And of all people, like, you have a lot to lose. Can you meet me halfway at least? And his stance on things was, whatever happens, I'm going to write a check and it's going to go away. And I had a real hard time with that. I thought, inevitably, there's going to be a case where you can't, like, that check will bounce. You can't write a big enough check to make that issue go away, right? Mm-hmm. And so an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. How about we dial it back, boss? And ultimately I realized, had to come to the realization that one of us was going to relent first and it wasn't going to be him. And so that was my cue to, you know, find the way out of that relationship.
Well, and that's actually a good point, though, too, in some aspects, in that, and I know we're getting on so many tangents, that's okay. Mm-hmm. There's been a lot of discussion with regards to the role of the CISO, talking about solar winds and all of that, and who owns the risk and who is responsible, who's the scapegoat, so to speak. And I've always held the position that the CISO, or in this case, a virtual CISO as well, is really one of their primary responsibilities is to let the board of directors and the C-suite have as much information about threats and risks to the environment so that they can make risk-informed decisions. And it's tough sometimes because in your case, it's like, well, he was making a risk-informed decision. He's like, I'm going to take the risk because I have compensating controls, a lot of money that will be able to handle that. And I think that's a level of reaching that maturity when you're becoming an advisor to businesses, that it's like ultimately, whether you're in-house advisor, CISO is still an advisor unless you actually are named an officer and you have responsibilities and can be held to that beyond that. But generally speaking, CISO is an advisor, and a virtual CISO is even more so as a consultant. And getting to that point and understanding that really you are a risk advisor is a level of maturity, I think, in the arc of any career.
Yeah, I try to get that across to not just my students and candidates, but also the people that I've hired over the years, that you have to divorce yourself of the emotional component. If you outline, you know, lay out the argument, this is what's at stake, these are the threats, this is the risk, and here's my recommendation, and whomever it is that you're giving that pitch to declines to acquiesce, one of two things is true. You made your argument convincingly, and they made a decision, or you failed to make your argument convincingly. In the latter case, now you have to make a decision. Do you turn around and go back into the room? Do you feel that strongly about it? Are you willing to die on that hill? Or do you just, you know, take the mental note and say, well, next time I'm going to, you know, approach this argument this way. But ultimately, it wasn't your decision to make. So, mm-hmm. So there's no point in being emotionally invested in the outcome. You know, just do your job, go in, lay out the argument, this is what's at stake, and let them make the call. Now, I think that in a lot of cases, it's not just divorcing yourself of the emotional component of making the pitch, making the argument to executive leadership. It's also the idea, you know, what I'm driving toward, what I'm circling around to somewhat circuitously is that a lot of CISOs end up being scapegoats because they want to absorb some of the responsibility for the program. And I say that, I don't want to say that flippantly, because of course they have responsibility for the program. But what I mean is, when executive leadership comes to them and says, how are we doing? What is our program? How secure is our program? There's an attraction to telling the tale in as favorable a way as possible. Oh, we're doing great, boss. We're totally doing great, right? Mm-hmm. We haven't had any breaches this year. Knock on wood, we haven't had any of these concerns. Our metrics look fantastic. A-OK, please remember this at review time, right? When realistically speaking, that is probably not the truth.
It's probably the worst thing to say, actually.
Exactly. And there's always something. You can pick any CISO out of a crowd and say, do you have like something that keeps you up at night or at least gives you pause during the week? They're going to say, pull up a chair. Right. Mm-hmm. Let's have a sit down and talk about that. But they don't have that exact same dialogue with executive leadership. Right. So I think that's a thing that we also have a tendency. It's sort of the superpower of the consulting side of the house. Right. Fractional CISOs, virtual CISOs, et cetera. If I tell a client to do that, I recommend a client do something and they don't do it and something happens anyway, I might lose that client. Mm-hmm. If I have the same scenario where I'm on the payroll for an organization, I lose my job.
And losing the client can be, unfortunately, a powerful motivator, and even losing the job too, but thinking about from the consulting side, could be a powerful motivator for giving advice that maybe that they want to hear instead of what they need to hear. Would you agree with that?
I would totally agree with that.
Because that's one of the common themes that I've heard on this platform is a lot of times people will say, well, bad advice is really one of the largest risks that in that environment that there is. And then I can understand the draw, but obviously certainly don't agree with it. And I think everybody has that moment, though, in time, at least one, but I can think of one for myself when I did exactly what you said. New CISO, new job, and going out to lunch with the CEO of the company, you know, meet and greet. It's like, this is great. It's like I'm getting FaceTime. This is wonderful. Mm-hmm. We're building a relationship. So he asked me over a burger. He said, so are we secure? And I said, yes, sir. Instantly regretted it.
Mm-hmm.
And probably about an hour or two later, it's like I went to his office and said, let me just clarify that. It's like, I haven't seen anything in the 3 days that I've been here that gives me any angst, but I've only been here 3 days.
Right.
And I'm sure that there's something. And he kind of laughed. He's like, Greg, I knew what you meant. It's like, you know, but that's okay. But it wasn't okay because that's the worst thing that you can say.
Right.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, I completely agree. And I always try to lead in with anybody, whether it's a client or, you know, somebody in a different capacity, that secure to me is at best, it's like a rare flower that grows on the side of a mountain and blooms for 30 seconds every spring, right? Mm. You are secure and then something changes, something happens, often outside of your control. Now you're not secure. And so it's the first thing I try to tell everybody that I'm speaking to is that there's no utopian oasis where we get there and now everything is secure and we don't have to worry about this. This is diligence. This is brushing your teeth every day. This is the way we are going to conduct ourselves from now until it's time to hang it up and hand it off to somebody else. And that's just how it is. And so secure? No, never. I could never sign off on that. No. So I I'm sure you appreciate this as well. It's one thing for me to tell candidates and you know, subordinates and stuff, this, that you've got to commit to this. This is the way you have to conduct yourself. And then I'll be the idiot looking somebody in the face going, yep, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, yep, perfect. Everything's great. And then regretting it, just as you said, you know, not 10 minutes later.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of risks involved with small and mid-sized businesses in that space, and understanding and making sure that you're giving them the right information so that they can make actionable decisions is certainly mm-hmm. something that we're responsible for. But you've been in the small and mid-sized market now as a consultant in cybersecurity for quite some time. Mm-hmm. What do you feel? We've actually touched on a few risks already, and it may be one of the ones we've already touched on, but what would you feel is right now one of the most significant cybersecurity risks for small and mid-sized businesses out there today?
They just don't have the bandwidth. I think that most small and medium-sized businesses fall into two buckets, either those that understand they're at dramatic risk and just don't have the bandwidth to do anything about it, never mind that they don't know what to do. There's just no room in their day to absorb that knowledge or engage the right professionals, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Or they're still stuck in the idea that they're too small. They're not a target. And the case that I usually make for those organizations typically is that, let's say that we have two companies. We've got you and we've got a major corporation, right? You know, with hundreds of locations, thousands of employees, et cetera. If the same attack is perpetrated against you and the large corporation is going to weather that storm. They're going to, you know, even if they have just a trash information security program, risk management program, they're going to weather that storm. I mean, look mm-hmm. at literally Target. As you unfold that story, it just makes Target look like bumbling idiots from a risk management perspective. They're still operating. But that same sort of attack that occurs to, you know, Bob's Tackle Shop, Bob's closing the doors the next day. That's just how that's going to be.
I don't remember the end result of that, but the vector in was, I believe, an HVAC shop in Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. Did that shop end up closing because of that? I don't know about that.
I don't either. And in fact, I think that that's telling, right? Not only did the media not zoom in on that, it is entirely possible that that company folded, you know, in 2014 when this thing happened, and nobody knows, nobody cares, right? And that's also a part of the you know, pressure on small and medium-sized businesses. Like a ransomware event could end you in an instant and nobody would know the difference. what does that mean for you, right? Well, how do you want to prepare for that sort of thing? My first exposure to ransomware was actually as a consultant for a small business. And the irony of the thing is that I hadn't even heard about ransomware at the time. This was about 2010, 2009, 2010. And I had literally just gotten done trying to pressure the client about their backups. You know, hey, your backups need a bit of work, right? They're sort of ad hoc. They happen when you think about it. We need to have a larger conversation around backups because you have a date with destiny here. Something's going to happen. And so the client reached out to me and said, you know, describe the situation. And I thought, that is really bizarre. What are you talking about? Went down to the site, looked at the screen, read the message. And I thought to myself, this is a nuclear weapon. This is the most elegant, most dangerous, most beautiful thing I have ever seen in my life, right? I'm not waxing poetic about ransomware. I think that it's a plague on our society, and I want 5 minutes alone with ransomware distributors. But when I first experienced it, again, I thought this is an ender.
It's the perfect attack. I mean, if you think about it.
Yes, it is. It's using a thing that we would never in a million years let go of ourselves, encryption, mm-hmm. against mm-hmm. us. And that's perfect. It's symmetrical. It's perfect, right? But so in that instant that I was, you know, I'm not even done reading the message from the ransomware application, when in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, oh, here's all those conversations about backups, right? Like, hey, I don't know what to say, right? Like,
and you can't say, I told you so.
No, you can't.
And they can't come back and say, well, why didn't you warn us about this ransomware stuff? Because, well, you know, I've never seen it before. This is like a new thing. But it doesn't, that is such a good point, is that it doesn't change the fact that doing the basics in information security is important today and going forward. It's important to lay down that, it's kind of like a body. It's the more that you do healthy habits, you should eat right, you should get a lot of sleep, get a lot of rest and all that. Well, I mean, what difference does it make tomorrow? Tomorrow is like, you know, I don't have that much of a stressful day or whatever. But what if something happens to you like one day and you get sick or something, or emotional or what have you? The whole point being is that prepare yourself for the threats that don't exist yet. And you're going to do a lot because there are going to be threats that don't exist yet that you got to be prepared for. That's a really good point. I didn't think about that. And I remember those days too, with regards to ransomware, thinking something similar, because prior to that, and I might be off base on this, I might be glamorizing the history, so correct me if I'm wrong, but prior to that, if a machine got infected, it used to be that, well, really the worst thing that could happen is that, you're going to lose your machine access for a little while. Okay, we got to rebuild it. And then it kind of moved a little bit. Well, they could use it to jump off if you're doing these drive shares. You know, everybody was running SMB. I think some were running it over the internet,
right,
at the time. But still, I mean, okay, those were things. You had other protections in place and this and that. Things that were easily recoverable from, nothing major as far as long-term damage. But now we have, as you said before, could be that nuclear world-ending event for an SMB. It's a big deal. And we've been dealing with it for 14 years. And yet, to your point, that we still have SMBs that are thinking that they're not the target. And part of that is because they don't have the bandwidth to understand. Well, how do you get to the point of getting them to understand without them getting hit? Because once they get hit, it's like they have, as Kim Komando would say, backup religion. Once they get hit, they understand. But how do you think is the best way to get it in their head to understand this is an issue?
Well, so I have this internal war, because I'm generally disdainful of FUD, fear, uncertainty, and doubt. And I always advocate for the idea that this is a risk. It's a roll of the dice. You can go bludgeon somebody with news about an attack, or if you don't do this, this is the worst case scenario. But you can only do that so many times before, you know, you wear out that.
Your white noise. Yeah.
Yeah. End up being white noise. Yep. As well as it's a hit to your credibility if you say this is going to happen and then it doesn't, and it falls short of the disaster scenario that you laid it out to be. And so usually what I'll tell people is, I want you to think about things in the context of what you have access to, what you know you have the ability to control within your organization. Now, imagine tomorrow you can't do any of that because it's inaccessible. And worse, not just you, it doesn't impact just you, but everybody else who uses those shared resources. And so what would that mean to you? It's also a backwards way of sneaking into conversations around business continuity. Let's talk about RTOs. Let's talk about RPOs.
Tabletop exercises. Yeah. I was thinking exactly the same thing.
Right. Exactly. Like, imagine you can't do your job for a day. Do you shrug it off? Okay. Now imagine you can't do your job for a week. Can you shrug that off? Is that going to be okay? And so, I try to talk people through these scenarios based on the outcome. And in a lot of cases, I won't even mention ransomware because it is just one small part of the larger, threat landscape, right? And in fact, ransomware has more or less become ransomware used to be the threat. And in some cases, when it's just a spray and pray sort of campaign, it still is. It's the sum total of the threat. But now it's just a cudgel used in the context of a larger attack vector in a lot of cases, right? Somebody gets into your environment, they will occupy that environment or whatever they can access for days, weeks, months, and they're only deploying ransomware when they're ready to get loud because they're ready to get paid. And so, again, ransomware is not the threat anymore. It's a part of a threat, toolbox, an attack toolbox.
Mm-hmm.
And that's scarier still. You know what I mean? I mean, that's almost worse than when it was just, oops, I clicked a link and ransomwared my local PC, because to your point, we used to have much wider, that was going to be poorly worded phrasing. We had networks that were much more widely accessible to the entirety of the organization. We got a P drive and an S drive and whatever else. And ransomware would execute in the context of the user who had been unfortunate enough to launch it. Well, if that person only has access to one network share, only one network share is mapped, their machine got borked and that one share had to get recovered. Hopefully, right?
Right.
But now the stakes are much higher. Ransomware is hitting the backups and it's hitting, whatever it can touch inside the context of the user account and outside.
And they're exfiltrating information too.
Yes.
During all this, which is part of that expansion of the ecosystem with regards to ransomware. So it's like, all right, well, we realize that encrypting your stuff isn't as big of a deal as we thought it was because now everybody has actually gotten backup religion. We need to do something else with it. We're going to sell your data or expose your data unless you pay the ransom. So and it's ever changing. I mean, again, we were just talking about simple things to prepare yourself for the threats for today and for the future.
Mm-hmm.
So very sobering. And of course, this gets me now to thinking about stress and cybersecurity and all that. We have, particularly those of us, I've been around a long time, you've been around for quite some time. And there's always something stressful because things do change and that's okay. Sometimes people thrive on the stress with regards to that, but it can be negative as well too. And I think it's very important that people get away from that stress and decompress. What's one of the things you do to shut off from cyber and recover and recharge?
Well, I'll be honest. Since I was a teenager, I've been hopelessly addicted to cars. And so, I don't do as much wrenching as I used to. There were times where I would take a car down, on a Friday night and still be wrenching on it on Sunday night, need it to drive to work on Monday morning, and those days are over. That's not a part of my life anymore, but I'm still drawn to the culture and drawn to, being around that sort of thing. And so this is as good a place as any to make a pitch for a group that I'm a part of called Rally North America. Every year we do a rally for charity. It's basically a scavenger hunt. There's 80 teams that come together in some small town somewhere in America. We know where our hotel is at the end of the night, but we have no idea about where our checkpoints are during the day until we get to, the green flag. They hand us a clue card. We got to figure out what's on the card, how to get there and do so, more quickly than everybody else without encountering law enforcement. And I hasten to add that a lot of folks are like, well, that sounds like Cannonball Run. No. if you get so much as a parking ticket, you're disqualified. You're an ambassador of yourself, the organization, and the charity, right? And so it's a game of navigation. How can I get there quicker than everybody else? Let me find the right, you know, the right path to do so, you know? So every year, or almost every year, I try to make sure that I go out for that event. It's usually four to 5 days, or I guess 3 to 5 days. And it helps me to not just be in a vehicle and be around other enthusiasts and other vehicles, but also to see parts of the country that I haven't seen before or wouldn't normally go to. And our place in the grid is dictated by how much money we raise for the charity. So for those of us that are competitive in that way, it's also a tremendous, you know, we're doing something good, right? It helps the heart. You know, we raised $220,000 for the charity this year, and that's, you know, that's aces.
That's awesome. And so I guess that's part of your future plans for this year. Mm-hmm. Anything else coming down the pipe that you want to chat about?
I've been working on some things. There is a series that I've been posting on LinkedIn, and I'm trying to make sure I do something more than just, you know, LinkedIn posts with this thing. But if you search the hashtag build a better client, a part of my ethos for the last several years has been, you know, breaking down the relationship between service provider, you know, managed services, whether it's just help desk as a service or whatever, and client and their clients, because I see there's a tendency for service providers to look down their nose at certain clients. Gosh, I wish this client was better at this. Gosh, I wish this client was, you know, more savvy about this subject matter, et cetera. If you want a better client, build a better client, full stop. Ask the questions that you want answers for. Don't just wait for the client to come to you, right? And from the client, and I make this public, it's not just for the consumption of service providers. I want clients to see that same content and say, hey, yeah, you know what? I'm going to pick up the phone and I'm going to call my service provider and I'm going to ask those questions as well.
So very good. So the hashtag for that is build a better client. Mm-hmm. I will say that I don't think, going back in my memory, that either Bandit or Snowman got a ticket, because Justice, Jackie Gleason's character, never caught them. Came close, never caught them. Couldn't give him a ticket. Now, I'm not advocating that, though. But it's always good to bring up a very good classic movie in these things, and I appreciate that. And I appreciate your time, Mike. It's been a great conversation. We're a little over from what we usually do, but that's my fault, because I was really getting into the conversation. I appreciate that.
I'm happy to be a part of it.
All right, everybody, stay secure.